Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is oncologist and author Dr. Azra Raza. She's joined in conversation by physician and philanthropist Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Azra Raza and Shoshana Ungerleiter.
For more than three decades, Dr. Azra Raza has cared for cancer patients. A leading oncologist at Columbia University, she's had a front row seat to our country's war on the disease, tracking medical breakthroughs and keeping current with the latest research. At the same time, Dr. Raza has watched the cost of cancer treatments continue to grow exponentially, along with the suffering of her patients and their families. And it is a suffering Dr. Raza knows well. For 5 years, she tended to her husband, Dr. Harvey Preisler, as he was dying from leukemia. His illness confirmed for Dr. Raza what she already had started to believe. Modern medicine is getting it wrong. Dr. Raza shares her personal journey and suggests new approaches to the fight against cancer in her remarkable new book, The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. Appearing in conversation tonight with Dr. Raza is Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, a physician, speaker, philanthropist, writer, and founder of EndWell, an end-of-life conference committed to generating human-centered, interdisciplinary innovation for the end-of-life experience. She's also the executive producer of Netflix's Academy Award-nominated film, Endgame, and she funded the Academy Award-nominated film, Extremis. Please join me in giving them both a very, very warm welcome to the JCCSF.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and thank you all for being here tonight. So I would love to start by having you read a little bit from your incredible book.
Thank you, Shoshana, and thank you for doing this. Thank you, Stephanie, the JCC staff and organization. I'm deeply honored to be here and also honored to be sharing this room with Harvey's daughter, Sarah Preisler, and her husband, Stocky, who are here as well. So thank you very much. As a background for what I'll read, the title of the book is The First Cell, but in a sense, it's the subtitle which is equally important, The Human Cost of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. I feel like we have become so obsessed with wanting to cure a disease that we have forgotten about the illness. Disease is something that doctors diagnose and treat, but illness is what patients experience. And we've become completely focused on cure, and we are forgetting about healing. So the reason for me, one of the biggest reasons to write the book, was to bring the patient back front and center into the conversation once again, and to look at everything we are doing through the prism of human anguish. And of course, I lost my own husband 18 years ago. But what forced me to actually write the book now is the story of a young boy, Andrew, my daughter's best friend, who 2 years ago, at 22 years of age, gets diagnosed with a brain tumor, which is not resectable in its entirety. So from day zero, we knew that nothing can be done for this young man. And one of my best friend's sons, Umar, who forms chapter one, who gets diagnosed with a highly malignant bone tumor called osteogenic sarcoma and has a very painful death. And so the question I asked myself was, how many Andrews will it take for us to be shaken out of our complacency and look at what exactly we are doing. So my best friend Nahid, her son Omar dies, and Shahrazad, my daughter's best friend Andrew, he dies at 23. And it, so I'll just read a little passage from this. Some sorrows are unfathomable, language incapable of expressing them. What combination of letters could possibly speak the unspoken thought of the mothers Nahid and Alena as they bid unhurried farewells to the serially dying parts of the creatures they birthed and nurtured for decades? The anguish has no beginning and no end, no relief, no ascent or descent, no respite, collapsing past, present, and future into a bottomless pit. A new language needs invention to encompass the defenselessness, the vulnerability of these two mothers who, with utmost delicacy, ease their boys into the grave one piece at a time, each over a period of 16 months, tormented until their child's last breaths about how to make the bewildering segmented departure less painful. Umar had 7 surgeries to remove slices of arms and lungs, a cancerous-filled shoulder. In Andrew's case, first the limbs went, followed by the bowel and bladder, then his eyesight, and in a final insult, he could swallow no more. To dare to mourn with Nahid and Alena, one must own the sorrows of the universe. No linguistic hyperbole can do justice. Language becomes speechless, vocabulary held hostage by the raw agony of such incalculable scales. The infinite care with which Alena washed, scrubbed, and dressed the wasted, limp body of her 23-year-old, or the relentless, whacking, blistering, piercing, frightful terrors haunting Nahid in every waking hour and in sleep, deplete the hubris of death. Elevate the status of motherhood to where the stars lower their gaze. One spark of pain in the heart of these mothers eclipses the glory of the sun. Dust raised by their agitation conceals deserts. Their tears forcing a river to recede, dragging its forehead obsessively in front of their grief. Hota hai neha gard mein sehra mere peeche, ghista hai jabin khaak pe darya mere aage. Next to me, the wilderness is shamed into hiding in dust. The servile river grovels in the dust before me. And to end, I'll read this last part. Basically, the pharmacon we offered Umar and Andrew encompassed 3 meanings of the word. Prescribed to fight the tumor, chemotherapy and radiation therapy would serve as both remedies and poisons simultaneously. The treatment would destroy the tumor in one area as new ones erupted in 100 others in brutal acts of ruthless, diabolical, vicious reciprocity. Of course, there was no hope of any improvement in survival. The poisonous side effects would land these boys into the hospital for weeks and months with their mouths and esophagus one big, raw, open wound. The third meaning of pharmacon refers to the ritual of human sacrifice. By testing experimental drugs in humans, knowing little about the risks and benefits involved, yet hoping to learn from observations made on the current subjects, were we not turning the societal demands, inner desires, conscious concerns, and capricious arbitrary violence on Umar and Andrew in order to secure a better outcome for others in the future? We gave those awful treatments anyway because the alternative would be no less agonizing. Mm-hmm. Allowed to run amok, cancer is one of the most painful, horrifying diseases. The fundamental question for both Umar and Andrew related to making this impossible choice: succumb to the ferocity of cancer or seek refuge in palliative treatments that temporarily control a growing tumor, but come with their own set of excruciating side effects. Die from the disease or die from the treatment? What would you choose? And why are these the only choices we are giving?
Really impossible choices to make. Yeah, it's like a beautiful passage. Thank you. So you're a very busy academic oncologist, seeing 30 to 40, probably more than that, patients a week. In your book, you know, you write a lot about the fact that our approach, current approach to cancer treatment and the research for cure is wrong, that we've gotten it wrong. You talk about that in your book a lot. And so I wanted to have my first question be, tell us more about that. Why is it that, you know, we're getting it wrong? And we'll get more into the details, but I just wanted to first ask that question.
I think that's the million-dollar question. Why are we getting it so wrong?
In maybe in what ways are we getting it wrong? Let's start with.
Well, the most glaring way is that after $200 billion spent in research, why are we using this Paleolithic caveman treatment, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and surgery? What has all that billions of dollars done? Where are the new treatments? My question is, I was using the same two drugs to treat acute leukemia when I came to this country in 1977. I'm using the same two drugs today with the same dreadful results. So all these new treatments that we proclaim from the rooftops as being game changers actually have ended up benefiting a very small fraction of patients and actually harming the vast majority. Not just harming them physically, Shoshana, but also financially ruining people.
Yeah.
I'd like to begin just by giving you a few statistics and then you can go to the next question. Number one. Do you know that of the experimental drugs that are brought to the bedside today, 95% clinical trials fail in cancer? 95% fail. The 5% that succeed should have failed because they are only improving survival by mere months. Under great pressure from advocacy groups, the FDA has lowered its bar of approving a drug to improvement in survival by 2.5 months. You tell me what 2.5 months means to a 22-year-old boy. And at what cost? 42% newly diagnosed cancer patients in this country, 42% become completely financially ruined by the end of 2 years. They lose every penny of their life savings. This is unconscionable and unsupportable going forward.
And these things aren't talked about, right? So we know that we often see the popular press, CNN the other night said they picked up a story where the cancer cure has just been found, or there's this new magic bullet pill that's been discovered, right? So in what ways is the media failing us in terms of this narrative, focusing on molecular level wins, I will say, small things, but that get misconstrued by the popular press, what is as being a cure-all, and how is that problematic for people?
Brilliant question. You know, I'm from New York. You know that because I was trying to bring my bag
right,
stage.
Right. Yes.
New Yorkers have a very good way of saying this. These great victories that are announced from the rooftops as game changers, they forget the subline. They don't. They put that in fine print. Curing cancer in mice.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's plenty of healthy mice running around New York. Anyone's been on the subway, you see them. They used to have cancer, but now they're cured. And the media just over, because everyone is starved for good news in cancer.
Yeah.
So anything that feels like a lifeline, they grab onto it and they start proclaiming it from the rooftops. And my point is, it's profoundly unfair to the actual patients to do that kind of thing, to build up expectations to such a level that when their oncologists are not offering them the cure, the patients feel like they're being cheated somehow. That they have read all this wonderful thing that's happening, the advances, so why aren't they being offered that? And I can't agree more with you about this, the overblown propaganda that goes on. So, for example, immune therapies, that's a fantastic new area. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm very much a big supporter of immune therapies. But at the moment, they are too expensive, too toxic, and benefit too few people. My colleague, Siddhartha Mukherjee, mm-hmm. who wrote the great book, Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, he just had, a couple of months ago, a beautiful piece in the New Yorker.
Oh, I love that piece.
Yes.
About immunotherapy.
Immunotherapy.
I learned so much reading it. Yeah.
He really got it down pat completely because Mukherjee pointed out that this wonderful cellular CAR T therapy right now is good for essentially 7,000 patients a year. So out of 1.7 million, 7,000 patients, it costs too much. I mean, just to prepare the cells is $500,000. And then you have to treat the patients in ICU. And just to manage the toxicities, whole industries are sprouting to do that. So the point is that, again, I'm not saying that it's not the right thing to do, but look, there are many people in this room, I'm sure, who have cancer or who have had cancer or who know someone who has had cancer, who has lost somebody with cancer. So it's not something that's happening somewhere else. This is very close to all of us now. And I don't want to paint a doom gloom picture for anybody. In fact, my book is a very forward-looking, very optimistic, futuristic look at what can happen if we just do things a bit differently.
Yeah. So early on in my training, I'm an internist, I was mentored by some really fantastic palliative care providers. Has everybody heard of palliative care? Yeah, a field of medicine that focuses on the relief of suffering for people and their families facing a serious illness and can be used at any time during the course of illness. And I learned that treating disease is not the only way to reduce suffering. And physicians, as you said, truly do have a role in healing when cure isn't possible. So also important, I think, to note that patients sometimes have other goals beyond just fixing their underlying medical problems. But we don't know that because we don't often ask them. And so how do you approach this with your patients? You care for a lot of people who are very sick.
Yes, and I think that I have to admit one thing, though, that in my 35 years in America, I have never met an oncologist yet who didn't care about their patients.
Yeah.
I have not met them. And our styles are different, but basically everyone is trying to do the best. And most of my criticism also is directed at myself because we have created a system which has taken choice out of our hands,
yeah.
In fact. As an individual oncologist, for example, I know that one of my patients who has end-stage acute leukemia develops pneumonia. Now we are going to intubate her and put her on a respirator and start treating her pneumonia as if the leukemia doesn't exist, which is really what's killing her. It's the worst thing you can do for the patient. But why do I have to do it? Because that is the law. If I don't do it, I will be in jail. Secondly, choices of treatments don't depend on oncologists either. Because, for example, pancreatic cancer. If somebody is diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, there are nationally approved guidelines developed by key opinion leaders. That first line of treatment will be composed of these four drugs. Then if they fail that, second line, third line, these are the drugs. If you deviate from that, you are opening yourself to legal challenges.
You're listening to oncologist and author Dr. Azra Raza, whose book is The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She's joined in conversation by physician and philanthropist Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So then, where does individual responsibility end and society's responsibility begin? So for me, it is a very it's an issue which changes with each individual patient, because in the end, patients teach us how to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. Our problem is that doctors are known to interrupt patients every 18 seconds. We don't want to hear them out. We don't want to. So I always tell the young people that, you know, just show up and listen and let the patient teach you. Maybe it's time for you to read my advice.
Yeah, I think this is so important. That there's this core doctrine of medicine. It's first, do no harm. Everybody's heard that. And part of, I think, harm is actually abandoning our patients, not being there to listen to them, to sit with suffering, and to be okay with that. That's definitely not something that's taught in medical school and not selected for when we choose applicants for medical school. And so you talk about this in the book in a really beautiful way, and so I want to read a very short bit here. My message to young oncologists is that until you find a cure, make sure you are upholding the fundamental role of medicine. First, do no harm. Each physician evolves a unique clinical style of dealing with patients, as you said. But the one that never fails is spending more time with them. A surprising amount of success, as someone once said, comes from just showing up. And as Yogi Berra famously pronounced, you can observe a lot by just watching. It's so true. It's so true. And yeah, I think that deserves a... I think for a lot of reasons, we don't or feel like we're not able to spend the time that we maybe even want to spend sitting with patients. But then the question is, what do we do about that? You know, what are the ways that we can help to change the system such that I think patients want to have more time with their physicians. We want more time with them. So I think we're in agreement that that's the right thing to do. It's just the question of how do we change the system to work better for all of us.
My biggest problem is that why are we doing all of this? Why aren't we getting beyond it? I have been having these conversations, the same treatments, the same side effects, describing over and over for 40 years. And you know, I recently carried on a project that I call the Cancer Questions Project. What I did is, I came up with 5 questions that I decided to ask 50 of the top oncologists in the country. Luckily, I am so old that my Rolodex is very good. I know a lot of good the leadership in oncology now. And I'm very persuasive, so they can't say no to me.
Yeah.
So I asked the same 5 questions. And the first question is, I was treating acute myeloid leukemia with 7 and 3, 2 drugs that are popularly called 7 and 3 because 7 days of one and 3 days of another. So this is supposed to be a combination of 2 drugs, but my late husband Harvey and I used it as a code word. 7 and 3 for us meant that if somebody is using 7 words, when 3 would suffice. So we'd be in a perfectly serious conversation and Harvey would lean over and say 7 and 3, meaning he's carrying on too much. But so the first question I asked is, I was using 7 and 3 in 1977. In 2019, I'm using 7 and 3. Can you tell me some way to change it by 2029? And so can you, this is the top leadership in the country I'm asking, the same question. And I didn't get a clear-cut answer from anybody. Mm. It's always more money, more research, more molecular findings, more immune therapy, you know, the same things we are doing. But the point is, Shoshana, that I have lived through so many cycles of excitement in cancer research and treatment, followed by crushing disappointments when it comes to actually benefiting. In the 1980s, when I first started, it was all about oncogenes. We are going to discover the next oncogene and have a magic bullet to treat it. That fell by the wayside. In the 90s, it was all about sequencing the human genome. Once we have sequenced everything, we'll find the mutations, we'll target them with specific drugs, targeted therapy. That has done nothing. Nothing, basically. They seem to establish a paradigm, which is that cancer is caused by one mutation which can be targeted with a magic bullet. So let's just find the right mutation for ovarian cancer, the right mutation for lung cancer, and develop a drug for each. And that was very misleading, because it turns out that practically all other 99% of the cancers have multiple mutations that can't be targeted with a drug. So that's the explanation. So in the 90s, human genome is sequenced, and most of 2000 we spent trying to develop these targeted therapies. Now it is immune therapies that's become very popular. And definitely some cancers have been helped, but not cured.
Yeah.
Helped by months or maybe very short time.
Yeah.
So you give the same drug to 100 patients, 20 to 30 will respond for a brief period of time. That's great for 20 to 30%, even if it's for a few months. But what about the 70 to 80% who experience no benefit but suffer all the toxicities and lose all the money and die anyway?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the solution then? The only answer that comes to mind is what has been successful? Early detection.
Yeah.
Because mortality from cancer, this is very interesting. On 24th of October, Time magazine had taken out an issue on medical advances, healthcare. It's a very lovely issue for future. And our leader of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins, a brilliant scientist who is now the director of NIH, mm-hmm. he was the leader of the Human Genome Sequencing Project, a man that I greatly admire. He gave his vision for the future of healthcare in America. And in the very first paragraph, he says that mortality from cardiovascular disease is down by 70%. And for cancer by 1% a year. So what is the difference? The cardiologists were smarter than us. They saw that the best way is to prevent heart attack from happening, fix the coronaries as soon as they start getting blocked. So the mortality from cardiac disease has come down because of early detection and prevention. In cancer, mortality has come down by 1% a year for the last two decades. So it means it's down by 20%. But that 20% is not because we developed a new treatment. It's for two reasons. One, anti-smoking campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And two, the screening measures. And the ancient screening measures like mammography, colonoscopy, pap smears, and PSAs, just with those four gross tests. Imagine in this day and age when we boast of godlike technology, when we are cutting and pasting DNA, what are we doing? Smashing women's breasts in mammograms and putting in a tube to look by eye for a tumor. I mean, how primitive can you get?
I ask you.
Why? And even that has helped bring down the mortality. So I'm saying, why is everybody in this country investing money in developing new drugs in an enterprise which has a failure rate of 95%? Why? Because they know that if one of their drugs shows a 10-second improvement in survival over 2.5 months, they will get the drug approved and then for the next 20 years make $1 billion a year.
Yep.
That's why they are ready to invest in something with a failure rate of 95%. I make a very simple argument in my book. We are trying to develop the most sophisticated techniques to recognize the minimal residual disease, the last cancer cell that is left after all the gruesome treatments we give. We have developed highly sophisticated technology to identify that minimal residual disease. Why not turn that whole paradigm and go for minimal initial disease?
Yeah.
Diagnose the first cell instead of the last cell. So somebody told me the other day, well, Dr. Raza, won't the pharmaceutical industries be so much against you because you're going to take away their lifeline? I said, no, they will love it because right now their only subjects are the 1.7 million people diagnosed with cancer. But since no age is immune from cancer, Omar gets it at 38, Andrew gets it at 22, Harvey got it at 34, his first cancer, and his second one at 57 and dies from it. No one is immune, so it means we have to forget about using the gross screening measures once a year, rather treat the human body as a machine and constantly monitor it for the appearance of abnormal pathways being perturbed because of disease and try to address it right there. And my point is, if you set a new goal, and in a capitalist system, if you financially incentivize it, then everybody will go to that. So the whole paradigm can be turned upside down overnight.
If we have good tests, right? If we can figure out how to identify that those early cells. And I think also, but I think I hear you saying, identifying pre-cancer or the first signs of cellular change that would then lead to cancer. But also, of course, you're a fan of prevention, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we should be arming our primary care providers with more tools, getting people, you know, better access to care and doing the lifestyle prevention things like what the cardiologists have figured out how to do to prevent cancer from happening.
And a lot can be done in lifestyle area also, but of course people can have the most pristine lifestyle and still get cancer because in the end it is just a random mutation that can happen. So both have to be done. You must have a good lifestyle, but still you are at risk, so you should be monitored. My point is, why can't we develop that technology? Of course we can. We're all doing it. I mean, it's not like these things are not under development. For example, I'll give you a couple of examples. You can go to sleep now in bed sheets that can scan you overnight. Stand in a shower that can image you. You sit on something called a fit loo for toilet. Yeah. And that takes part of your urine and can examine it for the presence of biomarkers that would alert you to the presence of malignancy. Or you can use a toothbrush. You can use that can take part of the saliva. I mean, there is a clinical trial going on something called a smart bra, which is now fitted with 200 nanosensors that detect changes in tactile, in temperatures and circadian rhythms, so that women, instead of having mammograms once a year, can simply put on this bra for 2 hours a week, and that monitors them for the appearance of cancer. There's a clinical trial going on in Stanford. So the point is that these are all technologies in various stages of development, but they can be catalyzed dramatically to happen faster and accelerated in their development if we put the right resources. And please don't think for a second that I'm saying all the money should go to the finding the first cell, because we have cancer patients now that we need to worry about.
Yeah.
So we can't stop doing everything possible for the patients now. But I'm saying that instead of going after 95% trials that are failing, some of that money plus some of the money being wasted on mouse models, testing drugs, Again, I want to make one thing very clear, because I'm misquoted about it all the time and then I get hate mail.
Oh, no.
The next.
What is it?
People think I'm against mouse models or animal models. No, I'm not at all. I mean, these are fantastic biologic tools to study many different things. We have to use mice and animals. The only thing I object to is you can't simply give a drug to a mouse, see the tumor disappear, and then pretend that it will have the same effect in humans.
Yeah.
You know why, Shoshana? One of the important things that people don't realize is most of the people studying cancer never see the disease.
Meaning they're spending a lot of time in the lab. Not
a lot of time. They're not MDs.
Yeah.
So they're researchers. They're studying diseases that they never see in animals who don't get them. You're creating something which you think is cancer, which you've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you study it and you find a drug and now you want to bring it to the bedside. 95% failure, 5% that succeeds is by chance, extends survival by 2.5 months. That's basically it.
And massive toxicity, I think.
Massive toxicity. So and I mean, what are we doing to patients? That's the whole point of the book.
Yeah.
Why are we doing it? And what is... I really don't want to attack only the pharmaceutical industry. That is unfair. Because if you go to the corner drugstore and buy 100 Band-Aids, it will cost you $3.99. But if you go to a hospital and somebody puts a Band-Aid on you, $75 for one Band-Aid. I
or
mean,
more.
This is obscene. But they can get away with it. And if you don't pay, then you have to mortgage your home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So... it's not just pharma industry, it's the whole business that has become, medicine has become a business. When I came to this country, doctors were running hospitals. Today, businessmen run hospitals. So why are we only blaming pharmaceutical industry? Because that is their stated goal, is to make a profit. Of course they are going to make a profit, but since when have hospitals become like that? But they are. And what's happened to our agencies who are supposed to protect patients? Why are they allowing these drugs to be approved?
Yeah, these are tough questions. I think there's a whole lot we could dig into there. I want to get back to something that really stood out for me in the book, and that was a question about language, and for the people for whom, you know, there is no cure for their disease or they're very late stage, we often talk about this idea of winning the war on cancer, right? Talking about the popular press again, not giving up the fight against illness. We often hear these words, these battle metaphors used in the setting of cancer. So can you talk a little bit about why framing cancer in this way is really harmful and really the wrong mindset for people facing this disease and their families?
Yeah. I don't know, in cancer particularly, remember chemotherapy really started with using nitrogen mustard, which was the thing used in the Second World War to kill. And so I think the metaphor really began from there, that instead of this war, we are going to turn it as a war on cancer. And I am particularly allergic to this kind of language, because when you are dealing with people who are dying on a daily basis, it's very difficult to think of this, because the only war that's going on is within the body, a war with cancer, or is it a war with chemotherapy that's hurting all the organs? Is it a war? Who is winning this war? Who's losing the war? The liver is better one day, but the lungs are worse the next day. I mean, and then the idea that somebody lost the war, which means as if they didn't do enough, as if it's blaming the victim. It's like the same thing about, oh, so-and-so survived cancer because of a positive attitude. Well, does that mean that the poor ones who died didn't have a positive attitude? It's their fault? This kind of language, to me, the semantics matter. Or we often say, the patient failed chemotherapy. No, your chemotherapy failed the patient. It's not the other way around. But we are so used to speaking like this. And it's deeply, deeply unfair to patients who are suffering.
Mm.
Yeah.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is oncologist and author Dr. Azra Raza, whose book is The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She's joined in conversation by physician and philanthropist Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so throughout your career, you've often cared for folks who are critically ill and die. We know that the rates of burnout among physicians and then other healthcare staff are astronomically high. So compared to the rest of the population, it's the rates of suicide are twice, depression, substance abuse. What do you tell your residents and medical students about how to take care of themselves? Because we know that we can't do a good job of caring for patients and expect good outcomes when we're not thinking about how we can nurture ourselves, especially when dealing with so much suffering.
Yeah. Recently, I read a neurosurgeon admitting that he often performs brain surgery when he knows it's completely futile because it's too painful to tell the truth. So if you can't tell the truth and if you cannot handle this, then you should be a plumber. You shouldn't be a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be doing this. How do we deal with so much sorrow and grief and anguish and agony and pain? Everybody develops their own style. The way I handle it, I tell my residents and fellows that patients have many languages. There is a corporeal language that patients have with its own sensory precision, its own syntax. And in order to understand that corporeal language, perhaps you should be reaching out into your own bookshelves and be reading the great works of literature that will allow you to stand in the shoes of others and feel their pain. That's what the whole Greek dramas were about, that you enacted the most difficult scenes on stage, and by empathizing and by verbalizing the pain and suffering, you somehow were able to accept it. What has helped me greatly is to read the great literature in many languages, Urdu and English both. For example, reading one of my favorite books, Moby Dick. I read every 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And Moby Dick is a book that made me understand the kinds of storms in the souls of men that make them go whaling. You learn to appreciate just the humanness about a kind of humanity that crosses nationalities and race, religions and cultures, everything. Because deep down, that harrowing sense of loneliness that we all have, that constant search for the essential mystery that keeps us up at nights and gives us this existential grief all the time, it's shared by all humans all over. And in the end, acceptance of mortality is a very human activity. The Greek gods could not accept mortality, but humans do. And being able to help others face it, walk through it, is, I think, and just to be able to witness it, to witness the nobility of their endurance mm-hmm. is a very beautiful thing, is a very great privilege to me. And I try to impart it to the others that they should treat it as a great privilege. In fact, I say this about one of my patients, Kitty C., that she's someone who took me from crayons to perfumes in this one particular area. Just to be able to walk on a daily basis with her. I'm very fortunate in one sense that the disease I treat often takes many years to take patients' lives. And over those 8 or 10 years, I'm seeing them once a week or once every other week at most. So imagine the number of conversations we have a chance to have.
Yeah.
And to get close, of course it's as difficult to lose them at the end also, but then just that privilege of witnessing the grandeur of humanity at that level is a truly sublime experience, in my opinion. It's something that should make us feel humble and make us feel really bend our heads in gratitude that we are able to witness it.
Wow. Well, I'm not sure I have another question to ask after that. That's just amazing.
Let me read a little poem for this.
I'd love that. Yes.
It's Emily Dickinson. I measure every grief I meet with analytic eyes. I wonder if it weighs like mine or has a different size. I wonder if they bore it long or did it just begin. I cannot find the date of mine. It's been so long a pain. I wonder if it hurts to live and if they have to try and whether could they choose between, they would not rather die.
Beautiful.
She's beautiful.
Yeah. I want to open it up to your questions.
Thank you so much. What is your feeling about stem cells in an advanced form of therapy? Thank you.
I'm very much for stem cell transplant. If it's possible to do it, it's curative. And the only thing I'd like to add to for everybody's consumption is that I make a prediction today, which is that in the very near future, the approach will be prevention for all chronic diseases. Because if you think about it, what have we really cured? Diabetes, hypertension, have we cured stroke, have we cured basically nothing except infectious diseases. So the best thing is to try and prevent what my friend Lee Hood calls the well-elderly. The well-elderly is what we want,
mm-hmm.
not the elderly anymore. And in order to do that, you just have to anticipate and prevent. Alzheimer's, anticipate and prevent. Cancer, anticipate and prevent. How do you do that? Well, that's the whole point, that we can measure analytes, metabolites, hundreds of them, that can give us the footprints of an appearing disease years before it makes a clearer clinical appearance. And once we have those markers, those footprints to anticipate, we can take action then.
Yeah. They have to be good tests, though, right?
Yes,
I that's definitely
what we have
think
to develop.
That, right? And so
liquid biopsies and biomarkers and devices and imaging and scanning techniques, they all have to be taken into consideration to develop this technology. They should have wearable devices that are monitoring. I'm working with biomedical engineers at Columbia University. Dr. Sam Sia, that I work with, he created the M-chip, which is already FDA approved. It's a little chip for men. They can prick their finger, put one drop of blood on it, and through microfluidics, it tests the PSA level, which is read by a little device at home. It's FDA approved, the M-chip. So all you have to do, you can monitor your PSA every day if you want. If we find the first footprint, so one thing I did Since 1984, when I decided that acute leukemia is too difficult a disease for to be cured in my lifetime, I decided to study pre-leukemia and try to prevent it from becoming this end-stage monstrosity which cannot be treated. So I've been committed since 1984 to early detection. And one of the first things I did was start saving samples on patients. So we have a tissue repository today with 60,000 samples from thousands of patients studied longitudinally as they went from pre-leukemia to acute leukemia. Not one single cell in this tissue repository comes from another physician. To this day, they're all, I do the bone marrows myself on these patients. So this, thank you. This whole tissue repository is there if we study it properly with all the current technology of genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics. We can trace everything back to pre-leukemia and then ask the question, why did a healthy individual even get pre-leukemia? What was it in their genetic makeup that made them susceptible? Once we have that biomarker, we go to healthy individuals and start monitoring the whole population. So what I'm working on with the biomedical engineers at Columbia is to develop a wearable chip which can be inserted under the skin, because you need to monitor from birth to death everybody for the appearance of the cancer. Just like we have put the PSA biomarker on this chip, we can put the one for pre-leukemia or acute leukemia or ovarian cancer or breast cancer next. So it could be a barcode of these biomarkers. It's all happening, but it's not happening fast enough. Mm-hmm. That's the point, and prevention will be the best thing for the future.
I had a question on a slightly different tack. When you talked about basically getting to the point where we can identify the first cell, and if it's, let's say it's a mutation, in your vision of sort of how things would be different, would that not require chemotherapy at that point? In other words, if we identify the first cell, then what do we do?
Very good question. So the whole idea is that some of the targeted therapies that are not working as well, only benefit for 2.5 or 3 months, they will be curative, just as CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, has proved to us that in the earlier stage, one magic bullet works, but as soon as the disease takes off, it doesn't. So that's one thing. Another is, for example, when cancer begins, you know that cancer cells divide faster than normal cells, so they need more nutrition, so they start making new blood vessels. So immediately the area becomes hot. Let's say I go to bed in sheets that are scanning me for the appearance of a hot area and it is found one night in the middle of my pancreas. Does it mean tomorrow morning I should have an open abdominal surgery and a Whipple's procedure and clean out my whole abdomen? Of course not. It means that we need to follow this for a while, monitor it every day, see if the area is growing, remaining the same, disappearing, what's happening. Once it seems that it is persistent, then we should do 20 other tests to find out whether it's potentially lethal and life-threatening or not. Is it an aggressive tumor or one of the things that will take 30 years to kill? And an old hag like me doesn't need to be having radical surgeries because I'm not going to be alive in 30 years. So the idea is that then 20 other tests should be done to supplement this finding by looking at liquid biopsies of the blood, looking for biomarkers, cell-free DNA, microRNAs, proteomics, whatever is available. And then once it is confirmed that this is indeed a potentially lethal lesion that is growing, then imagine using the same CAR T immune therapy to attack just a few million cells compared to hundreds of billions. When you suddenly kill hundreds of billions of cells, they choke up the kidneys, they block the liver, they cause damage to every organ. You're just killing a few million cells, that toxicity won't be there, it will be more targeted. And finally, you can even simply focus a laser beam and kill them. Kill that little lesion instead of giving 6 weeks of horrendous radiation therapy. So the point is that as we develop the means to detect cancer early, simultaneously we will find more and more effective treatments that are working in earlier stages. That's it. So I'm not worried about finding actually the treatment. Certainly better than this 95% failure rate.
The only thing I feel like I should point out is there will have to be a paradigm shift, right, in terms of how we think about when we're screening so heavily, right, and we're doing all these tests because cancer cells are so prevalent in the body throughout life, right? Well, often they get thrown away by the body itself, right? The machinery to help get rid of those cells. The stress and anxiety that people are going to have from the constant monitoring. I'm not saying that outweighs the benefit, but it's something to just think about.
Yes, right? But the constant stress and anxiety is there because nothing can be done right now. All you can expect is I literally say that treatment for cancer right now is taking a baseball bat and beating a dog with it to get rid of its fleas. That's what we are doing to humans by giving them chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and slashing their bodies. That's the kind of thing we have to stop doing that. Yeah. And the anxiety is because if cancer is found, that's what will be done to me. But if they know that cancer is found and it will be taken care of like it's a common cold. The last example I want to give is that, look, the Human Genome Sequencing Project, the first genome that was sequenced, took 15 years to complete and cost $2.7 billion. That was 19 years ago.
2003.
Yeah. 2003, the full one, but in 2000, President Clinton announced.
Yes, right.
So the point is, it took $2.7 billion in 15 years, 19 years ago. Today, we do it in 3 weeks for $2,000. This is the beauty of capitalism, if there is anything positive to be said for it. It can happen so quickly. So I'm saying that instead of keep tinkering with the typewriter, let's invent the word processor so we never have to look at the stupid typewriter anymore. Let's just move on. Enough, enough, enough already. At least this lady is saying enough. I've been saying it since 1984, and until I have one last breath left in my body, I will keep saying it.
Thank you. Thank you for everything.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was oncologist and author Dr. Azra Raza, whose book is The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. She was joined in conversation by physician and philanthropist Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.